Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the November 25th issue of People Magazine, as well as Oprah Daily, the online newsletter. I have some great articles to share with you today, including John Krasinski is the Sexiest Man Alive, The Wonderful World of Wicked, and Are Home Diagnostic Tests a Waste of Money? John Krasinski is the Sexiest Man Alive. After a crush-worthy role on The Office, the devoted family man is now one of Hollywood's hottest directors. By Julie Jordan, photographs by Julian Uncano. This is from People Magazine. John Krasinski has always tried to keep it real. Sure, fans might know him as a date-worthy paper salesman, or a former Marine turned CIA agent, or a devoted family man sacrificing himself for love, but the actor, 45, prefers just being a husband and father who binges documentaries and relishes bedtime stories with his kids. Krasinski, who lives in Brooklyn with his wife of 14 years, actress Emily Blunt, 41, and their daughters Hazel, 10, and Violet, 8, recalls a moment a few years ago when he was walking his older daughter to school. This guy went, "John? From The Office? Oh my God, it's so good to see you." And he walked away, says the actor. And Hazel said, "So you work with that guy?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Why are you lying to me? He said he knows you from The Office." Admitting it was a bit of a challenge trying to explain the truth, the actor just thought, "Wow, what an unbelievable head trip that is." Krasinski might have a little more explaining to do now that he's been named People's Sexiest Man Alive. Beloved for his 9-year run as Jim Halpert on the hit series The Office, he co-wrote, directed, and starred alongside Blunt in the 2018 thriller A Quiet Place. Its massive success spawned 2 sequels, while Krasinski also beefed up to portray the titular Jack Ryan for 4 seasons on the popular Prime Video series, now set to become a film. With this year's movie If, which he starred in, wrote, produced, and directed, the actor solidified his status as one of Hollywood's top filmmakers. Still, the transition took a little finessing. "I had to pitch the studio 54 times before they said yes," allows Krasinski, who stars with Natalie Portman in the heist film Fountain of Youth. "I'm pretty sure someone said, 'Sorry, is Jim from The Office going to direct this?' And I went, 'Oh, it's John, but we'll get there.'" Raised in a Boston suburb with his 2 brothers, Krasinski first tried acting in a 6th-grade production of Annie, but it wasn't until he enrolled in the National Theater Institute while attending Brown University that he discovered his passion. "It was one of the most transformative 14 weeks of my life," he says. "It grabbed my heart and my soul." These days, Krasinski is calling his own shots and appreciates the life he's built together with Blunt. It's that beautiful thing where when you're married to someone, you're constantly learning and changing and evolving, he says. "And I'm so lucky to go through all that with her." Not that his new title will change anything. "I think after this comes out, she'll be like, 'All right, that means you're really going to earn it here at home.'" What were your first thoughts when you heard you were getting the crown? just immediate blackout, zero thoughts, other than maybe I'm being punked. That's not how I wake up usually, thinking, is this the day that I'll be asked to be sexiest man alive? And yet it was the day you guys did it. You really raised the bar for me. I know you haven't told anyone, but assuming Emily knows, how did she respond? I'm not supposed to tell anyone? Oh my God, this is going poorly right away. I did tell Emily, and she was very excited. There was a lot of joy involved in me telling her. She once said if you got the cover, she'd wallpaper it throughout the house. Did she say that? Do we have that on camera? Because that's like a binding contract, I think. My children will love that. It won't be weird at all. Who do you think will give you the hardest time? I think probably my brothers will wonder how this is possible for years to come. Luckily, we'll go right into Thanksgiving, so we can jump in and talk about it right away. What were you like growing up? I guess I was a pretty imaginative kid. I was always living in some kind of world, whether it was pirates or some crazy adventure. Usually Indiana Jones, anything Steven Spielberg. I was friends with E.T. and picking up the Raiders of the Lost Ark idol and things like that, basically, from the ages of 4 to 45. How about in high school? I played sports. I was in band. I played the trumpet. I think I was trying to just be a guy who was having fun. I had friends in a lot of different groups. Were you popular with the ladies? No, I mean, if you look back at my high school yearbook, I think a lot of people wrote things like, thanks for helping me get through my breakup, or you're a great shoulder to cry on. I was really there for moral support, not so much in a romantic way. When did you find your self-confidence? Probably college. I mean, that was the most mind-expanding experience of my life. No drugs necessary. I was lucky enough to go to a great school and get a great education. But the education for me, really, was finding these life markers of people who brought me into the world of art, theater, and music. You first met Emily in 2008. When did you know she was the one? The second I met her, I don't know what happened, but I remember someone introduced us, and it was across a room in a restaurant, and I walked over her to shake her hand, and as soon as I did, I just knew. What do you love most about being a girl dad? Oh man, how much you learn. You just have these unbelievable wells of curiosity, emotion, and questions coming from someone from the opposite sex. When they ask me for the dude perspective, it's pretty fun because I'm actually the only dude in our family, including our dog. Is there something you can do that always embarrasses them? Dance. I'm terrible at it. I remember my phone turned on one day on the street, and it was Spoon song. I turned my camera on, and I started dancing. And Hazel went, "Oh my God, Daddy, there's people on the street." What does a typical day off entail for you? I usually drop the kids off at school, do a quick workout, and then try to find something exciting in the city to do. I just went to MoMA a couple days ago, and then some French bistro after. Just trying to experience all this city has to offer. Is there a hobby you wish you had? I wish I could play the piano or the guitar. I wish I had one of those in the bag. Not only to just be a great party trick, but also for myself. Do you have any stupid human tricks? other than weird voices that I do for my kids as their stuffed animals, I don't think so. I do like an Elmo-esque voice for them. And no, I will not be doing it on camera. What's your worst habit? Probably jogging my leg. I'm like a guy that if I'm at a table, he jogs his knee up and down. And this is fun, right? This doesn't make you nervous. Emily's told me that I do it a lot and that it still hasn't stopped. You've talked about Chris Evans winning Captain America over you. Do you have any regret over roles you passed on? You know, I've never had that. And it's Chris Evans. Look at the guy. I've weirdly never had that jealousy thing because I think in a lot of ways my life has been like winning a giant radio contest. You got to just take it as it comes. And I really do believe that every role is meant for someone, that if it's meant for you, it's coming for you, and if it's not, it's for somebody else. What do you think Jim and Pam from The Office would be doing now? Probably about to do bedtime and read stories. I feel like they're very good parents. Although, am I losing track? Are those kids like 80 now? How would you describe your own life? Beautiful. It really is. It's a phenomenal thing to get to be in this family and be a dad. It's changed my life entirely. Snapshots from his life. Teen spirit. That was kind of my look, so less awkward at the time, more awkward looking back, Krasinski says of this 1997 photo. Role model. This gentleman is the reason why I'm in the business, he says of Robin Williams with Mandy Moore in 2007's License to Wed. Boston Strong. That was photoshopped. We've never been in the same room together, jokes Krasinski of this 2016 pic with pals Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. Put me in, coach. I remember getting the call that he'd cast me, he says of George Clooney in 2008's Leatherheads. I still don't think I'm over that. Doing his part. When she looks like that, you just have to stand next to her looking halfway decent, the actor said of his and Blunt's appearance at this year's Oscars. Behind the scenes, The Office, 2013. Jenna Fischer was the best acting partner ever. I don't think I would have gotten that part or had any bit of success in that role if it wasn't for her. Lip Sync Battle, 2015. I was one of the creators of the show. I pitched my idea to Jimmy Fallon, but being able to pull off a spangly dress like that, that is pride. 13 Hours, 2016. That was the hardest getting in shape I'd ever done because it was a full-blown transformation on every level, from diet to exercise. A Quiet Place, 2017. One of the most thrilling processes I've ever had because I had never worked with Emily. Here I am pretending to give her a note because she doesn't need any. Some good news, 2020. When you say handy around the house, I can build a desk out of a whiteboard and two weird shelving units. So you're welcome, everybody. If, 2024. This was one of the most joyful moments of my life, creating this character and having Steve say yes to playing Blue. This or that. Rom-com or action. If we're talking 80s, 90s, it might have to be rom-coms. Sleepless in Seattle kind of trumps most everything. Am I right? PDA or behind closed doors? Definitely behind closed doors, because I don't think I've ever done PDA. Ryan Reynolds or Jack Ryan? I've got to go with Reynolds because he makes me laugh. Jack's not the most jovial guy. Office casual or red carpet ready? Definitely office casual. Starbucks or Dunkin'? I think I'd publicly be executed if I didn't say Dunkin'. Fill in the blank. I have an irrational fear of spiders. People would be surprised to know that I am scared about a lot of things, but you just keep trying. Yeah, you never really make it. It's always a process. The movie that always makes me cry is, if we're talking windshield wiper wiping off tears, Dead Poets Society. I always borrow this from my wife. Products in the shower. Although I don't know what any of them do, so sometimes my hair changes color or something. I always dream about directing, and there's usually a dog or some sort of shark tank. When I look in the mirror, I see a really, really lucky dude. This has been John Krasinski is the Sexiest Man Alive from People Magazine. The wonderful world of Wicked. Get ready for a holiday trip to Oz. Stars share a look inside the new movie version of the Broadway hit by Eric Anderson and Andrea Mandel. This is from People Magazine. Q&A, Glinda and her guy. Two former theater kids connected when Ariana Grande, 31, and Jonathan Bailey, 36, arrived on the set of Wicked. We were very giggly together. That was the tough thing for us, says Grande, whose bubbly, aspiring sorceress Glinda falls for the dashing Prince Fierro, Bailey, in the prequel tale to The Wizard of Oz. Both massive Wicked fans, pop star Grande and Bridgerton heartthrob Bailey formed an easy bond that gave us fizz, he says. Ariana, you first saw Wicked on Broadway when you were 10. What's your memory from that experience? Ariana Grande, other than my chemistry as a person being permanently altered, I loved it so much, and they were so kind. Kristen Chenoweth gave me a little magical body wash. I think it was magical, because look at where we are now. And she gave me a little wand, and her dog peed on the couch, and I helped her clean it up. Jonathan Bailey, didn't you have one of those on set? A little bottle? Grande, the Wicked Still a Lip Gloss collab from 20 years ago. It's gotta be poison. It's old, but I did have it with me for a little extra magic. Jonathan, did Ariana's backbending hair flips as Glinda make you laugh? Bailey, she flossed my teeth every time she did it. Grande, you're welcome. Bailey, I'm forever changed. Grande, I'm forever changed in a lot of ways emotionally, but mostly my spinal column. It's not good. Meanwhile, Jonathan was literally shooting Bridgerton and learning the choreography on his days off. He was flying in, having a dance rehearsal, and then flying back. Bailey, waddling back. I've been amazed seeing the final film. There's so much that I hadn't seen because I wasn't there on set. The performances are like knockout, obviously Ari and Cynthia, but the work that went into it is unprecedented. Who's who in the Land of Oz? Jeff Goldblum as the Wizard. The Jurassic Park alum, 72, calls Oz's ruler a storyteller, entertainer, narcissist maybe. Michelle Yeon as Madame Morrible. To play the Shiz University headmistress, Oscar winner Yo, 62, got vocal coaching. "I love singing, but normally it's in the shower," she quips. Marissa Bode as Nessa Rose. Elphaba's sister uses a wheelchair, and Wisconsin-born Bode, 24, in her first movie debut, is the first in the role who uses one in real life. "Representation is so important," she says. Bowen Yang as Funny. Glinda's judgy friend is someone who glommed on to his popular pal's social status, says the Saturday Night Live star, 34. Funny targets outcast Elphaba with his cruelty. Ethan Slater as Bach. The Tony nominee, 32, auditioned to play the Munchkin with a crush on Glinda 10 years ago on Broadway, but didn't get it. "Bach pines for community and love," he says. Getting Elphaba Green. As the future Wicked Witch of the West, Tony winner Erivo, 37, had the choice of being green while shooting or to have it later added with CGI, she has said. She opted for makeup. "I love transformation. Her green skin is part of the essence of who she is." She loved the freckles and varying tones created by makeup artist Frances Hannon. Wicked by the Numbers. 11 songs performed in Wicked Part 1, including fan favorite Defying Gravity. 20,000, the approximate number of beads on the bodice of Glinda's bubble dress. 140, crew members on the movie's costume team alone. 9 million, real tulip bulbs planted to create the look of Oz. 152, days spent filming Parts 1 and Part 2. This has been The Wonderful World of Wicked from People Magazine. The surprising relationship hack we can learn from children. Parallel play can make you feel even closer to a partner or friend. By Cassie Hurwitz, published October 1st, 2024, from Oprah Daily. Why is there something so deliciously relaxing about sitting in the same room as a friend or partner and reading different books without saying a word to each other? You can swap in almost any activity: scrolling, gaming, working, crafting, and the sentiment stands. It just feels comforting to be entrenched in your own world while kind of sort of being social too. If you want to share a thought or bounce an idea off someone, you know they're there, but there's zero pressure to engage. The reason this dynamic feels so natural is that we learn it as children. Parallel play is a crucial component of child development in which kids learn to play side by side, but not together. They're not isolated, but they're not interacting. It's actually one of our earliest forms of play, and it teaches boundaries, trust, and empathy. We do it for a few years before eventually graduating to cooperative play. Parallel play looks exactly the same in adults. We just have a different definition of play. Reading with a friend in the park, watching a show while your roommate takes personality tests on her laptop, doing the crossword as your spouse reads the business section. These all feel like socializing, but without the major effort of a dinner party. Parallel play isn't just a tonic for introverts either. According to Sasha Hamdani, MD, the board-certified psychiatrist and ADHD clinical specialist, behind At the Psych Doctor MD on TikTok, and author of Self-Care for People with ADHD. Being together apart helps anyone feel less lonely. It fosters social connections and reduces feelings of isolation, she says. It creates opportunities for bonding over shared interests, which contributes to emotional well-being and strong relationships. This is because it's a hallmark of secure attachment, says Julie Manano, a licensed marriage and family therapist and author of Secure Love. It's the sense of ease partners feel when they're confident they can reach out to each other and receive messages back to the effect of, I'm here if you need me, your needs matter to me, I delight in you. We are connected by something bigger than verbal interaction. Another quick benefit of parallel play? It's a boon for creativity and curiosity, Hamdani says. That's because your friend might be developing a painting skill while you cook. And there's room for both of you to explore the other's activity. It's also an antidote to hustle culture, Manano says. A Sunday spent in parallel play can be nurturing to the soul of each partner. If a couple finds themselves chronically on the go, parallel play can add a protective layer to their relationship. Don't rely completely on parallel play to stay connected with loved ones, though. It has potential downsides, like limited interaction, that may lead to superficial connections, Hamdani explains. It can create dependency on this type of engagement, hindering the development of deeper relationships. The solve is easy. Make sure you balance it with real, meaningful time together. For every let's be alone together moment, have a device-free dinner, go for a run together, plan your next trip. Engaged connections fill partners' cups and creates the emotional bonds that make periods with lower engagement safe, Manano says. Cassie Hurwitz, Associate Editor. Cassie Hurwitz is an associate editor at Oprah Daily, where she covers everything from culture to entertainment to lifestyle. She can typically be found in the middle of multiple books and TV shows all at once. Previously, Cassie worked at Parents, Rachel Ray in Season, and Reveal. Her love language is pizza, New York slices, Chicago Deep Dish, and otherwise. This has been the surprising relationship hack we can learn from children, from Oprah Daily. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Are home diagnostic tests a waste of money? These do-it-yourself kits are a $5 billion industry. We report on the pros, the cons, and the ones to avoid at all costs. By Rosie Hopegood, published October 10, 2024, from Oprah Daily. It used to be that if you had a niggling health concern, you'd see your doctor and talk things through. That doctor might or might not order further testing for you. A blood panel, say, that would involve getting pricked with a needle at your local Quest Diagnostics. It sounds a bit antiquated, doesn't it? These days, you can order a home test for everything from colon cancer to food sensitivities, sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, to celiac disease. Worried about your thyroid levels? There's a kit for that. Wondering whether your waning libido means you're in perimenopause? Ditto. Even if you don't have any health issues, It takes just a quick scroll to be persuaded that you do. Because your favorite influencer is plugging a microbiome testing kit, or an ad promises that a continuous glucose monitor will solve your mid-afternoon slumps. Business is booming for the at-home diagnostic test kit industry, which pulls in more than $5 billion a year, a number that's predicted to double by 2032. Everyone wants in on the action. In addition to the slew of online companies that have popped up, LabCorp now offers home tests via LabCorp On Demand, and CVS and Amazon offer do-it-yourself tests for kidney disease, diabetes, and heart health. We're sending off samples of blood, mucus, saliva, poop, and urine, but just how accurate and how regulated are these kits? And should we really be paying anywhere from $10 to $1,000 out of pocket for tests that might be covered by insurance if a doctor did them? Here's the full picture. The upside. For many, the appeal of home testing is not having to go through a doctor. Patients are often tired of leaving appointments without answers, so with Google at their fingertips, they're taking matters into their own hands. According to research, around 1 in 7 doctor-patient encounters end in diagnostic error. And last year, the hashtag medical gaslighting took social media by storm, with over 262 million TikTok views. It's very hard for some patients to convince their doctors that they actually need certain testing, says Michelle Sands, a naturopathic doctor and author of Hormone Harmony Over 35. Whereas after an at-home test, they can go in armed with information. Even if the doctor wants to order another test to verify, at least the patient is being heard and not being told, "You're 50 now, everyone's tired." No one is going to care about your health more than you do. Another major plus of home testing is that it can increase access to care. There are 121 million Americans, that's 37% of the population, living in healthcare deserts, meaning they struggle to access basic services such as primary care providers, pharmacies, and hospitals. For them, home testing can be life-changing. And for the 8.4% of Americans who don't have health insurance, home tests may be cheaper than an out-of-pocket trip to the doctor's office. According to Gabriel Gaviola, MD, a Harvard Medical School instructor and senior medical director at Everly Well, a company that specializes in at-home diagnostic health tests, another benefit is that it provides a layer of privacy for those who may not be comfortable visiting their provider in person. That's especially true for things like sexually transmitted infections. Everly Well offers a test that screens for 6 STDs at once for $169, which may or may not be worth it for people hoping to avoid a toe-curling experience with their longtime family doc. The downside. The biggest one is that you're paying out of pocket for a test that might otherwise be covered by insurance, which could be more expensive than the copay for a doctor's visit. Second, many doctors will want to order a retest of results from a lab they don't know because they have concerns about the quality of the test or may prefer a different modality of testing. Brian Blank, MD, a family medicine physician based in Greenville, South Carolina, often sees patients who have shelled out for saliva-based hormone testing, which he has found is less accurate than blood work. Patients usually take some convincing that the better way to do this is the blood test, because oftentimes they've paid a lot of money for this kit and they've watched somebody promoting it online, he explains. I tell them that we really need to take those results with a grain of salt. There's also room for user error. Just as you can screw up a home COVID-19 test, you can screw up a potentially expensive diagnostic test kit. Patients might not follow the directions correctly or take it at the right time, so they get a false negative or false positive, said Sands. That's where home kits can get a little bit iffy. She also recommends talking through the results with a doctor, as results can easily be read incorrectly. How to choose a test kit. The FDA has approved home tests for HIV, urinary tract infections, vaginal yeast infections, COVID-19, and flu. Home tests for colon cancer, such as Cologuard, are considered a really upper-level test, says Blank. Although they're not quite as effective as colonoscopies and do need to be repeated more frequently, they are a highly effective diagnostic test. In fact, the UK's National Health Service sends one to all residents who are registered with a GP and within the at-risk age group every 2 years as a pre-screen for colonoscopy. Generally, though, regulation around the industry is lax. The FDA doesn't review what it classifies as wellness tests, meaning any test that doesn't set out to diagnose a specific condition. We're talking tests that claim to measure stress or hormone levels, food sensitivities, cellular aging, or the levels of vitamin in your blood. There's also the loophole that most tests made and analyzed in a single lab, known as laboratory developed tests, or LDTs, don't undergo the same strict FDA reviewing system as one from mainstream manufacturers. Home tests? You guessed it. Many are LDTs. However, certain markers will tell you whether a test is high quality. Gaviola advises sticking to ones that are CLIA certified. CLIA stands for Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, which are U.S. federal regulatory standards. The second level of certification, which is a little bit more robust, is a CAP, College of American Pathologists accreditation, he notes. Companies with either seal of approval are likely to tout them in their marketing materials. You can also check if a particular test is cleared by the FDA by searching its database of approved home and lab tests. And last, skip these tests. While some home tests can give you data to discuss with your doctor, others are a waste of effort and money. Don't bother with popular food sensitivity tests that work by checking a blood sample for the immune system antibody IgG. According to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology site, this test has never been scientifically proven to be able to accomplish what it reports to do. The scientific studies that are provided to support the use of this test are often out of date or in non-reputable journals. Tests for fertility hormones, such as AMH. It's better to get this tested by your doctor as part of a battery of other diagnostic tests. Even though these tests are sometimes called egg timer tests, AMH alone is not a good measure of either the number or quality of your remaining eggs. Menopause predicting tests. These monitor levels of hormones such as follicle stimulating hormone, FSH, which fluctuates regularly, rendering results inaccurate. A woman who's clearly postmenopausal doesn't benefit from the test because it's not giving you new information, says Lauren Stryker, MD, an OB-GYN and certified menopause practitioner of the Menopause Society. A woman who's perimenopausal doesn't benefit because it's completely inaccurate. It won't tell her how soon she'll be postmenopausal. The third category is younger women who are worried that they're perimenopausal because they're struggling to get pregnant. If a home test catches them when they're ovulating, the FSH will be high and they'll think, oh my God, I'm never going to get pregnant. But instead of doing that test, they should have been home having sex, says Stryker. Any sort of testing that pushes products on you. You never want to take a test from a company that also sells a bunch of supplements that go with the test results, says Sands. Rosie Hopegood. Rosie Hopegood is deputy health editor at Oprah Daily. She writes, edits, and assigns stories at the intersection of science, medicine, psychology, wellness, spirituality, and fitness. A Brit in Brooklyn, her to-read book pile is taller than her toddler, but she's still pinching herself that she gets to read and write for a living. You've been listening to Are Home Diagnostic Tests a Waste of Money? From Oprah Daily. Why do I keep crying about the same thing? Tears can be a sign that you are actually healing from your trauma, not that you are stuck in the past. By Eileen Weintraub, updated February 21st, 2024, from Oprah Daily. The grocery store checkout line was wrapping around the produce section one Saturday morning, and the very pregnant woman behind me looked hot and exhausted, so I motioned her to go ahead of me. As we commiserated about the summer heat, my heart began racing, and I could feel tiny sweat beads forming on my forehead, despite the store's Arctic AC. I smiled along, but my mind flashed back to the moment 17 years earlier when my doctor, barely taking the time to look me in the eye, callously sentenced me to 5 months of pregnancy-related bed rest. I had unusually large fibroids, and she warned me that my baby might not survive. As this long-ago trauma washed over me like a tsunami, I made a mental list of all the things that could go wrong for the woman in front of me, who looked like she was smuggling a watermelon under her sweat-drenched shirt and could potentially give birth right there by the Tic Tac rack. By the time she began putting her items on the conveyor belt, I was so worried for her health and safety that I began feeling queasy. Logically, I knew that her experience would not be the same as mine, and my son had turned out just fine. But I felt like I was right back in my doctor's office, hearing my own diagnosis all over again, paralyzed with fear. As I loaded up my car in the parking lot moments later, I had to hold back my tears. Why couldn't I just feel joy for this woman? And why, after all these years, did I still feel so helpless and terrified when I recalled my own difficult pregnancy? Why did it still have so much power over me? It turns out that my meltdown at the grocery store was a sign of progress. Tracy Shore's PhD, a professor in behavioral and systems neuroscience at Rutgers University, and author of Everyday Trauma, considers this kind of event a normal stress response. "I wasn't regressing into my past trauma," she told me. "I was healing." Over time, she explains, the brain learns that just because you were exposed to a memory, it doesn't mean you have to be afraid. This resonated. It wasn't the first time the sight of a pregnant woman had triggered me, and it probably wouldn't be the last. To avoid a panic spiral, I just had to remind myself I was safe in the moment. A very helpful tactic, says Olivia Reams, PhD, mental health researcher at the University of Cambridge and author of This Is How You Grow After Trauma, is pinpointing what your triggers are. Knowledge is power, she says. The more we become aware of our patterns, the more we are in a position to change them. So how can you tell if you're moving forward, even when it feels like you're taking a million steps backward? Here are three self-defeating thoughts that actually show you're healing. Negative thought: I'm reliving a painful experience yet again. I must be stuck. Healthy translation: I'm aware of my body's stress response. I know it's natural. Sweat pours down your back, your jaw clenches, your muscles tense. This is a normal reaction when confronted with old wounds. Being aware of the brain-body connection and acknowledging that your racing heart and knotted stomach are just physical manifestations of a bad memory can dial down your anxiety and help the symptoms abate much more quickly. Shore suggests reminding yourself that a memory is just molecules that have created an image, but the experience itself is gone. Over time, your physical response to a painful memory will diminish as you remind your brain to stop being scared. Shores recommends a combination of aerobic exercise and meditation to feel less anxious and afraid. Exercise can produce feel-good endorphins, while meditation helps us slow down and become more aware of our thoughts and feelings. Negative thought: I still have moments of fear and indecision. Yep, definitely stuck. Healthy translation: I'm letting myself feel my feelings. That's how I'll heal. Letting yourself feel your feelings instead of suppressing them is a sure sign of growth. When you begin healing from trauma, you start to allow different complex feelings to emerge, Reem says. Instead of running away from your emotions and potentially turning to alcohol or substance abuse to numb or further suppress them, you allow yourself to move through them and emerge on the other side, hopefully freer from pain, fear, and indecision. People have complicated, sometimes even contradicting emotions around their trauma. You may experience anger and sadness, but also feel grateful that you survived the experience. Being able to acknowledge this without guilt or shame is the key to moving forward, even if it takes years. Reminding yourself that the trauma happened in the past and that you are safe in the present moment can help you identify negative thoughts, acknowledge them, and then stop them from spinning out of control. Negative thought: I can't stop talking about what happened to me. I'm stuck in a loop. Healthy translation: I'm confiding in people I trust. I'm not hiding or suffering in silence. It can make you feel incredibly exposed to share your deepest, darkest secrets with others. But when you take a risk and make yourself vulnerable to people with whom you feel safe, two wonderful things happen. You release a huge amount of stress, and you create a sense of trust. Shedding tears helps release oxytocin and feel-good chemicals. The moment you let other people see the real you, this puts you in a position to get better. It's a sign that you're opening yourself up to the real world and allowing other people in, says Reams. Crying in front of your friends, your therapist, and other people you trust is not only cathartic, but it also creates bonds and builds both a sense of community and a safety net. Maintaining strong connections has also been proven to help us navigate and ultimately move through difficult experiences. Next time you have a reaction to a past wound, don't isolate yourself. Instead, call a friend, let them know you need support, and unleash the cascade of tears. Traumatic events can be so devastating that it takes time for our brains to understand they are no longer harming us. Be kind and patient with yourself and accept the uncertainty you're feeling, Reem says. Meet yourself where you are. Eileen Weintraub is a New York-based editor and journalist and the author of Knocked Down, a High-Risk Memoir. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post, Glamour, InStyle, and AARP. Find her on X at Eileen Weintraub. This has been Why Do I Keep Crying About the Same Thing? From Oprah Daily. The True Story Behind Elvis's 1968 Comeback. A new documentary shows Elvis Presley like he's never been seen before. Netflix's Return of the King, The Fall and Rise of Elvis Presley, streaming now, explores the significance of the rock and roll legend's 68 comeback special that aired on NBC on December 3, 1968, when he was at a major crossroads in his career. Through its use of rarely seen rehearsal footage, the documentary shows just how much unease Elvis had about this moment. People would think, how could he be nervous? He's Elvis Presley, the singer's ex-wife Priscilla Presley tells People. He was very nervous. Prior to the special, Elvis, who became the biggest music star on the planet in the mid-50s, hadn't performed in front of a live audience in 7 years. Following his return from the Army in 1960, Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, got him locked into a multi-year movie studio contract. He became increasingly frustrated with the scripts he was being offered. One day he was reading a script and he threw it across the room and said, "I'm not doing this," says Elvis's longtime friend Jerry Schilling. The Colonel loved Elvis and vice versa, but Elvis outgrew the Colonel. Though Parker tried to get him to do a family-friendly Christmas special, Elvis insisted on a return to his rock roots. The special went on to become the highest-rated show of the year for NBC. Elvis dedicated himself to live performances from then on, and he played hundreds more concerts before his death at age 42 in 1977. With the documentary, Priscilla says, "I really want the kids of this generation to know why he was the king of rock and roll." By Breanne Tracy, this is from People Magazine, the Scoop section. Megan Fox is pregnant with baby number 4. Megan Fox and Machine Gun Kelly's family is growing. The actress, 38, and her rocker fiancé, 34, are expecting their first baby together, Fox announced on Instagram on November 11th. After experiencing a past pregnancy loss, Megan really wanted to get pregnant again, says a source. She loves being a mom. The new baby will join Fox's kids, Noah 12, Bodie 10, and Journey 8, with ex-husband Brian Austin Greer, and Kelly's daughter, Casey 15, with ex Emma Cannon. From People Magazine, by Brianne Tracy, with reporting by Pernilla Siedenheim. Thank you for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the stories in our program today, and make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for both Apple and Android phones. Have a wonderful day, and make sure you stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.